Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, and today we welcome back Bob Tomisch, Senior Lecturer in the UW Department of Horticulture and UW Extension. Glad to have him back, and certainly he can answer questions relating to the lawns, the flowers, the fruit trees, the garden vegetables.
We'll try to cover it.
Try to cover the whole thing. Nice to have you back, Bob. Thanks for coming. And I tell you what, if you want to join in, the number to call is 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. What kinds of questions are you getting these days?
Well, every day is always a little bit different. We're seeing some of the aftermath of this drought issue we've had across Wisconsin. In fact, this week I had a couple of samples of apples, pictures being sent. And I even had a sample I took into the pathologist this morning. We kind of work as a team. And,
sure.
And we suspect it's a kind of blossom end rot that we have seen in tomatoes showing up in some of the apple varieties where on the blossom end is just deteriorating, becoming very corky. And what has led to that is right after we had flowering, we already had a drought in the state. And so less water was being carried up for people that didn't have irrigation or anything, less water being carried up to that fruit growing point. And so you have less calcium there, and calcium is very important for cell development, structure, and holding together. And so we're seeing circles, oh, maybe an inch in diameter, just brown, corky. And it's only on the outer surface.
Yeah.
If the fruit stays on, I suspect it's nothing more than removing it like a couple of other blems. But they do look a little unsightly when they start, unless some secondary rot sets in. We don't know yet. So this is one of the first times I've seen this show up in a number of years.
Well, Christine in Juneau has a question for you, so we'll turn right to Christine. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. I have tomatoes in one end of the garden, and last year I'd had potatoes there, and apparently I did not get them all out. And I'm wondering if there's an interaction with the two.
Nope. What you left behind were a few of the tubers, and they are often growing. If you take care of all of them when your tomato production is done, you can then dig up your potatoes and harvest the tubers. It shouldn't have an impact. We do have some diseases that go back and forth, but if they are looking fairly disease-free, I wouldn't worry about it.
All right. There you have it. Thanks a lot for calling. And let's go to Stan in Duluth. On to you, Stan. Hello.
Hello. My question is, we put in a couple of apple trees last fall, and they were doing very well this spring. We had actually some small apples on it. But then one night the deer got to them and removed about half to two-thirds of the foliage and the apples. A couple of questions. Will they come back? And what's the best way to prevent it?
Well, you've got two issues going there. One of the things after they've gone through and did their pruning, per se, it's always probably best for the fruit tree if you can come in with your pruning shears and just prune back between that from that jagged cut that they left behind. This time of the year, sometimes that bud behind there will take off and start a new growing point, and that'll help the tree out. As for keeping the deer away, well, there's a lot of options out there. If you want to physically keep them out with electric fences and that type of thing, there are some spray products that you'll see available in some of the garden catalogs like deer hindrance and some of those things. And I think Scott Craven probably has a list of some of those products as well. But Scott Craven is our wildlife biologist. Anyway, some of those products can be applied, but you have to, if you have a heavy rain or a rain of more than a half inch, you have to come in and reapply the product. And the odor usually keeps the deer away. So you have some of those types of options.
How high would a fence have to be to help out if you were to put the signal
up? Usually electric fence is better than a high fence. And we've had fairly good luck in some of our research plots where we've put a double fence up, one at about a foot and a half electric and another one at about 4 feet, and then set out about another 4 feet from that fence another wire that's at about 2.5 to 3.5 feet high. And deer, while just touching it, they'll tend to stay away, but they have trouble calculating the distance. So, but you have to have it electrified, and those little rascals will come around to check.
That probably wouldn't work. How about these sprinkler things that
scares them away?
Motion?
Motion detectors and sprinklers, I've heard, will help. And it keeps, when the fruit starts ripening, you have the raccoon, possum, and those critters showing up. Sometimes that'll keep them away. Bear, I don't know how. In northern Wisconsin, you have a bigger cadre of pests.
Good luck, Stan. And usually some combination. It's usually not just one thing, but several things.
Yeah. I heard that some of the scent motion detectors hooked to a sprinkler system has a fairly good scare tactic.
Good. Good. Thanks, Stan. Jane in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I've always wondered, I'm trying to get rid of weeds in certain areas to put in flowers, and I'm wondering if the weed little pieces of root that would be left in the ground that are too hard to get out, will they resprout into new plants?
Yes.
Oh.
One of the things to look at, I don't know where, what stage you're working on, there are some products out there. Roundup is a pretty good one. And applying that on those perennials, and we'll talk about quackgrass and some of those types that, and what happens, if you get it about 10 days, it will usually kill that underground root structure or rhizome. It could be a stem structure in that case, and you'll have some pretty good success going that way. But that doesn't mean that the weed that's 2-3 feet away won't send a rhizome over into your nicely watered, fertilized, et cetera, well-tilled garden plot and start all over again.
Right.
That's where people sometimes will just spot treat. Where they just will maybe have a little sprayer device of Roundup and just spray the stem of quackgrass?
Mainly I'm thinking about violets, and I am digging them out by hand and getting the rhizome part.
Yeah, but there's a seed bank in that soil as well.
Yeah.
So even though you get the perennial structures, there's some seeds that, and I don't know what the viability is, it might be anywhere from 10 to 30 years on violets, and so they'll come back.
Right, but if you get the rhizome, and then there's still root hairs left, those root hairs will also
usually not the root hairs, if we're talking about a smaller structure. It's usually a stem-like structure or a little bulblet that's left behind.
Right.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Jane. Chris in Two Rivers, on to you now. Hi, Chris.
You just answered one of my thoughts about my trouble with thistles. Oh, I can't get rid of them.
Yeah.
They're either using Roundup or a 2,4-D product, mm-hmm. and you can usually find that in most either farm stores or garden centers. Those will work fairly well. The secret is when you're trying to really knock them out, is you want them at a height somewhere between 4 and 10 inches, and that's when they're most lucrative. So with a thistle situation right now, they're flowering. Cut those off, and as they send up their new shoots from the root, then start spraying that. Thistles are probably one of the more difficult ones to control, along with quackgrass, and it may take more than one application of herbicide to knock those down.
I wanted to try growing a new strawberry patch. Can I do it this time of year?
It's getting a little late to set out transplants.
Mm-hmm.
Usually with strawberries, I would start tilling the area and controlling those thistles that you were talking about.
Yeah.
If you can knock those down, and then next spring, put your order in for the strawberry varieties that you want, and then do the planting. That way you've reduced the seed population. Sometimes even in the tilling process, you bring up new weed seeds, and then if you do it about every week, it'll knock down those your seed bank population.
So what do the commercial growers do when they're done with their picking the berries? What do they do with that land? Do they let it barren until the next spring and plant?
Well, usually strawberry growers will probably grow strawberries for about 4 years on the same parcel. And each year they're replanting probably 1/4 of their acreage.
Oh,
and they rotate through it. And then when they're done with, for example, this season's growth, they will usually go in and plow down that area. They might allow it fallow for a year or two to reduce the diseases that might have populated there. They might grow sweet corn in that plot or winter wheat or something. And they go through a couple year of that, and then they'll come back in with strawberries.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling, Chris. Appreciate it. An email from someone, Joanne, who says, would like to know when's the best time to transplant flowering plants. I've not done transplanting myself and am nervous about the process. Example, daylilies. I have a beautiful display in my front yard. Would like to separate and transplant to some bare spots for next year. Also, I have a flowering purple plant, oh, which I can't name, which I would like to do the same thing in my backyard. Well, purple plant, it's hard to know what that is.
Yeah, but we can use some of the, we'll use some general basics here. Generally, the best time to do your transplanting is either late in the fall, in October, after we've had a fairly good frost, and the energy is now stockpiled in those rhizome-like structures, as in the case of your daylilies. And so that, or early in the spring until things begin to grow. Usually our frost comes out of the ground sometime in early to mid-April, and you've got probably a 2-3 week period there before anything even starts growing because the soil temperature is cool enough that we're not having a lot of cellular activity down there. So doing that dividing either now in the fall or in the spring will give you the best results.
All right. On to Roger in Fitchburg. Hi, Roger.
Hi, I have quite a few trees and bushes around my house that I value. They were put in years ago, and I hired somebody to mow the lawn for me. And this guy has works for a larger company that does this kind of work, shrubbery and tree maintenance, and has a little business on his own. He's mowing the lawn, and asked a couple of times over the past several years if he could cut back those bushes so they would be more convenient for the mowing. And I told him no, that I would pay him more if he would just go under the bushes and do spot mowing and so forth. But a couple of days ago, he chopped back those bushes anyway and ruined the appearance of the front lawn, it looks like to me. Makes me sick. I'm wondering how long it takes, something like that. I suppose I have to get someone in who would do some selective pruning or something like that to make it look better. But how long? I have two questions. How long does it take something like that to recover so it looks good again? And can a small claims court, a small claims court work again?
Well, you'll have to pursue that part yourself. But just to give you a rough idea, one, you might want to contact an arborist, somebody that's licensed.
Certified arborist,
to do an appraisal. And usually the best time to be doing that pruning is in the spring, not this time of the year. And with the spring, and there's ways of rejuvenation, and there's a reason we rejuvenate, especially shrubs, is that we end up with new young growth, and then we have more flowering or fruiting or whatever we're shooting for. And usually we're growing that shrub for for a color reason somewhere along the way. So if you could contact somebody like a certified arborist, they can help you out there.
Yeah, an arborist had already cut them back to make that happen, and he butchered them further.
I doubt that this was a certified arborist. You look for a certified arborist.
And they can show you their card or whatever.
Yeah, okay.
Just because they have people that maybe work for a landscape maintenance company, and they probably are not certified, but you want somebody that's on the up and up to take a look at that.
All right.
All right, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. I'd take a few pictures, too, right now before. And if it's a bigger company, there may be some recourse there for you. Karen in Portage, we're on to you. Hi, Karen.
I have been studying cold weather, or actually winter gardening, using a pod method, and then leaving some things in to freeze into the ground, like parsnips and carrots, and like the pod method uses Swiss chard, spinach, lettuce. What would happen if, when I dig my long row of potatoes up, I would leave individual potatoes in the ground to freeze in through the winter? Would they start their own growth in the spring?
It all depends how cold the potatoes had gotten. Just as the first caller said that she had some potatoes coming back.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that, in the case of potatoes, is if they're cold, they lose their flavor if they get real cold. That's why they usually store potatoes at high 30, right around 40 degrees. But whereas the carrots and parsnip, when they're at those colder temperatures, they convert starch to sugar, which gives them a better flavor. Now, you're talking about freezing in the ground. What you want to have happen is the ground to get cold but not freeze, and you can protect that or keep that soil from freezing by placing a layer of like straw or hay mulch. Some people will take straw bales and put them right down the row of carrots. And then just lift the bale up, and usually it's not froze under there. It's kind of like a permafrost, and you can dig the plant material out. in northern Wisconsin, you get up around Bayfield, they have snow there by the 1st of November, and the ground never freezes, I think, once every 20 years.
Yeah.
And I can remember having a field day up there in February, and somebody brought in fresh carrots that they had dug that morning, and they were great.
So would a potato turn into a perennial?
Potatoes are a perennial. And by a perennial, mm-hmm. we have what we call hardy perennials, like our peonies, which overwinter and then grow.
Mm-hmm.
We have some like dahlias that are half-hardy perennials, which we dig to protect that tuberous root, and we have to place them in storage. Usually potatoes, they're kind of like the half-hardy. Many times, once they get a certain temperature level in that soil, they may kill.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Bob Tomich, Senior Lecturer in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison and UW Extension. Our guest here, Jim Packard, our producer on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here on this edition of Garden Talk as we visit with Bob Tomich. You want to join in, give us a call at 800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org. We'll move on now to Eau Claire. Let's talk to Brooke. Hi, Brooke.
Hi. I've got a terrible problem. I've had it for years. They're especially bad this year. Stalk borers, and they're in everything, like hollyhocks, sunflowers, zinnias. They're in everything all over the farm, all over my garden. It is an old, old garden going way back to before the 20s. And I talk to other people. They don't even know what I'm talking about. And what can I know I do save half the plants by putting down this spectracide. I don't like using chemicals, but it's the only way I can save them. And my dad thought lime. So what's going on? What causes it? Thank you.
Well, you probably have more than one borer that's causing the problem. We do have corn borers, which sometimes will move to other plants. And what you're trying to do is keep that adult insect from laying an egg on your plant material, which when the egg hatches, Junior burrows inside, and then he's well protected. So that's why some type of pest program. When your father, whoever was, spoke of lime, these were products that they had used prior to the invention of the pesticides that we have today. Like the old Bordeaux mixture, which was a lime sulfur, which protected the grape plants from diseases as well as some insects, was used in France several centuries ago. And the reason they started that is to keep the big predator, humans, from eating the grapes because they look so lousy and they tasted lousy until they were washed off using that lime sulfate. So basically, I would say a fairly good pest program. One of the things with pesticides, and it sounds like you have a real problem, and it could be that the insects are moving from the cornfields where they overwinter and finding your garden just as tasty as anything else, and the adults are laying eggs. There are moths that you probably see on the window, which are the adults that will be laying eggs that on your plant material. So again, just coming with a pest management program is about all that you can do. The other thing, keep in mind that once you have a rain, it's time to replace that pesticide so that when they do lay the eggs won't be hatching, or Junior will die as soon as he hatches. And the other thing is that even if it doesn't rain, like we've had, 3 weeks without rain till this morning, and in a situation like that, you still need to replenish it about every 10 days. It'll say so on the label how often to do that, because the ultraviolet light does break down those chemical products.
Okay. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call, too. Danielle from Madison emailed us, just bought a house. Let's just say the backyard is a little brambly. We want to establish some flower beds for next spring. But is there any way we can do it without having to resort to hacking and digging out all the weeds?
Boy, if you come up with a solution to that.
Yeah, well,
generally,
there is a solution.
If you have a weedy situation like that, I would start now. It's a nice cool day. Anyway, I'd start and go through with a mower, chop off the above ground area, and then mark out where your flower beds are and follow that up with a Roundup application. That will knock out the perennial structures. If you don't want to use chemicals, some people will take a dark black plastic and put it over the area, leave it there for about 6 weeks, and it will also kill a lot of plant material in that zone. Mm-hmm. So you've got a couple of options.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Let's go to Hazel in Eau Claire now. Hazel, hi to you.
Hi. Hi, how are you?
Great.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm just very interested in trying to actually get my fruit trees to bear fruit. They're new plants. I try to start all over again, and they're newly in the ground. They seem a very good quality, and I just want some advice on how I can actually get them to survive and thrive and bear fruit. They're six apple trees.
Well, you might want to start out with some pretty good wire mesh guards around the trees to keep the mice and the rabbits from damaging those that this winter.
Okay.
If you're in a deer-populated area, you're probably going to have to look at some type of fencing to keep the deer from feeding on it or a spray product.
Yes.
So you've then allowed them to survive till next year. And they normally have to grow about 4 years before you end up with what's called scaffold branches. And you might want to go to the extension publications that we have. One is on home fruit trees fruit trees for home gardeners.
Okay.
And that would be, they have some very good information about training those trees to space your scaffold branches. Those are your producing branches that go horizontally.
Okay.
And then one last step that you can do is usually around the fourth year when the scaffold branch is the diameter of a half inch. Do what's called ringing, R-I-N-G-I-N-G, and you do that around the 1st of June.
Okay.
What you do is you go out there when you've gotten a speeding tick or something, you want to take your vengeance out. Anyway, you go out there and you take a sharp knife and you squeeze it and you cut through the bark, and then you make a ring all the way around. What you've done is severed the bark, but water travels through the woody part, sugars travels through the bark that are produced from the leaves. But anyway, that concentrates the sugars in those scaffold branches. And when that happens, you have flower blood initiation happening around the 15th of June. So that'll tend to trigger that plant to flower the following year.
Oh.
And usually within a month, that cut that you made in there heals up and everything's back to being transported the way it's supposed to be.
Okay.
And the date is very important. It's around the 1st of June.
Okay.
You don't want to miss that by 2 weeks, because what you want to happen won't happen.
Okay. And this is all on your website, is it?
Yes.
Well,
oh, perfect.
The booklet, publication certainly is on the website.
Yes.
Okay.
And the concept of ringing, if you have do a Google search on ringing apple trees, and you might you get all kinds of other junk, but focus it on the fruit trees.
Excellent. And I don't have to worry about pollination or any of that stuff to get the fruit to come. That just happens.
Pollination takes place if you have different varieties, because apples do not self-pollinate.
Okay.
And the other thing is, usually we have enough pollinating insects. Our bee population is down, but there are some other pollinators, and they'll make the tree happy.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling, Hazel. Gary in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, good morning. In regards to Bob's comment earlier on Blossom End Rot, old German farmer a few years back told me that to stop this blossom end rot because of the calcium, lack of calcium, he always uses a handful of Epsom salt, like around his tomato plants, when he first gets them going. And I don't know if that would work on apples, but I was just wondering if Bob has ever heard of this.
Yes, I've heard of it. And what you're doing is actually adding a fertilizer material down there with both calcium and magnesium. The issue is that you also need water there to carry it up to the tree. And this year, there probably was plenty of calcium in the ground, just that we didn't have the vector of carrying water up to those growing points, and that's why we're having that physiological problem. In the case of tomatoes, we would solve the problem if you had a regular water supply to those tomatoes. They would not develop that blossom end rot situation, because generally there's enough calcium in the soil and generally be carried up there. What you're doing with adding the Epsom salts is just adding a little more fertilizer material. Yes, it does help. There are other calcium products that are on the market that you can use.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
And I might caution you, don't want to use too much, because if you have too much fertilizer, you'll cause a burning on the margins of your leaves.
Let's go to another caller here, Ron in Boyceville. On to you now. Hi, Ron.
Yes, hello. Hey, I have a 4-year-old asparagus patch that I would like to relocate to a different part of my yard, and I'm wondering when's the best time and how I should go about trying to move these plants.
Well, let me share something with you. I would go prepare your site for your new location and start with new transplants. Many years ago, we had an asparagus plot going at one of the research stations up at Spooner, and I had a 4 foot wide tree spade that dug a 4 foot wide cone, and we dug out the asparagus plants, and they were about 4 years old. And you know what? That 4 foot tree spade was not large enough to dig the entire root.
Oh, okay.
Because you end up with a lot of storage roots in that. Sometimes if you can get just the crown and carry it over, but usually you cause some injury to the plant. And anybody that says, well, I'm going to go out in the wild and dig an asparagus and move it in, you can do it, but you're farther ahead to just order some new transplants and get the whole project going over again.
I think I'll leave them where they are. They're doing pretty good.
Okay. Thanks, Rod.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Let's see. Susan emailed us, I'm looking to plant wintergreen seed directly to a slope in early December. I understand that this method versus planting starter plants can be risky. Have you heard of success with this method in southeastern Wisconsin?
You've got a whole host of issues. First of all, southeast Wisconsin, I believe, has a high soil pH. Depends on where you are. Usually your wintergreen likes more of an acid environment. And so that's going to have a little hampering on your that. We see a lot of seeds of native plants for sale. Some studies have shown that less than 95% of those seeds actually germinate into a mature plant. And so I usually try to encourage people to use transplants where they start the plants in a very protected environment in the greenhouse and then set those transplants out, and you'll have much better luck.
All right, on to Pete in Pleasant Springs. Hi, Pete.
Hi, good morning. With this wind and rain we had this morning, I noticed we have two rows of sweet corn in our garden, and they're at about an 80-degree angle now. I don't know if I should let nature take its course or go out there and try to upright them or what I should do.
You must have got a lot of rain, something we really didn't get.
No.
Yeah, we got a pretty good rain down there.
Yep. I'd let Mother Nature take over there. Usually when this early in the game and at the height they are, they're going to correct themselves, and those brace roots will be starting on the corn stalk. That usually happens on the node or two above the soil line, and things should straighten out. I'd give it a couple, 3 days.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, thanks a lot for helping. You save some work.
Yeah, I got to put a steel post by each one.
Let's go to Bill in Bayfield County. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I was wondering if I should prune tomato plants. I see all that vegetative growth on there, and I've seen pictures of the commercial growers where they have all this fruit and hardly any vegetation. What do you recommend?
Well, with the pruning, this is something that what you're doing is removing not only the leaves on the bottom portion, but any shoots that develop in the axils of those leaves. And sometimes even after you've gone through and done the pruning, you'll have to come back and there'll be some additional shoots that'll come out. What they're trying to do is eliminate most of the shoots for about the first 8 to 12 inches, and they're also trellising those plants. And by trellising, there's many different choices that you have, either using horizontal trellis or some people use posts and tie it to the post. But they were trying to get that vegetation off the ground area because many times there are diseases that come from the soil and splash up on the leaves. So that's how they're doing it. They're doing their pinching, and each time when they're pinching out, what they're doing is just a single stem instead of having four or five stems growing up there, and that's what gives you that mangled mass. So you want to try to pinch it back to a single stem if you can.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Anita in Delavan emailed us, Bob, and says she has a ranch house on an acre and a third, built in the 60s. Believe the trend at that time was to not have trees in front of the house. I would like to have some. The house faces east. I'm looking for shade and beauty. I don't know what kind of trees would be appropriate for this application. I know that fir and conifer trees wouldn't work very well because they cut the view back. So she wants something that'll give her shade but also be able to see through.
Yeah, and a lot of the seeing through part of it is some pruning activities. Many people plant a tree or landscape tree and they don't come back and do the pruning. By pruning, that allows you to kind of, well, first of all, to remove the lower branches so you can get under there with the lawnmower to get back to this individual that had a challenge earlier. But also thinning out some of the branches, usually saving a branch about every 12 to 18 inches is plenty. And I would shoot more towards the 18 inches. This allows sun to filter through, which will then keep your grass growing under your trees. As for choices, there are a lot out there. You might want to look at some of the maple varieties. There's honey locust, which would be a choice. There's linden. There is a posted on the extension list is a list of trees for Wisconsin, and I would take a look at that. We're trying to also encourage people, since we have some issues with we had Dutch elm disease come through back in the 70s, but we also have the potential for emerald ash borer expanding, is to try to encourage people to have tree diversity where you have no more than 30% of one species in your yard. In your case, you have an acre and a half. If you had 10 trees that you would plant there, no more than three trees of that one species. So having species diversification will help you.
Frankly, I wouldn't be putting an ash tree in there either.
No. It all depends on how well you want to gamble.
Right. On to Kenneth in West Allis. Hi, Kenneth.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
All right, I have an age-old question here, and that's I hope you have a solution for it, to keep the squirrels out of my peach tree.
Huh. Well, are there trees around your peach tree?
No, there aren't, but I've already caught, I trap them. I caught eight squirrels already this spring, and I've got them pretty well cleaned out, but all it takes is one squirrel. And, you know, they keep filling in. The nests that I catch them from, the other ones come filling in. But there are no, well, there are a couple of trees around, yeah.
Yeah, they migrate in, and squirrels are probably the most difficult to control because they're very decisive and they're very good planters. Watch them around a bird feeder somewhere at some time, and they'll give you an idea.
Oh, yeah.
Really, other than trapping, and you've done the one right thing now is trapping early, you know, using a live trap and bait, so you've reduced the population before the fruit ever ripened. The other thing you know, we talk about bird netting and that type of thing, but a squirrel will just chew right through that. So really, I have no other options. Electric fence might work where you set one close to the ground about an inch off or so. And let them get zinged. We did that one time when we were trying some hazelnut project, and we set a little electric fence to keep the chipmunks and squirrels away. And we had it about an inch and a half off the ground.
Oh, yeah.
And they would come up to it and smell it once, and they would make all kinds of noise, spin around.
Oh, yeah.
So you can do it, but and then you might want to set a second wire up about 4 or 5 inches. So.
All right. There's one other question I have, too. Has this been an exceptionally great year for peaches? I'll bet four times as many peaches that I've ever had before, and I've been culling them because I know you're not supposed to let peaches grow closer to six inches apart. And I must have had a couple of thousand peaches up there.
Huh. Yeah. I would have forecast last year that no, it isn't, because we had 29 degrees below zero, and usually peaches get zapped at about minus 15 or 20. But for some, they made it through. Apparently, that cold came in slow enough, and the tree could acclimate, and it left respectively. But I'm hearing reports across the state of those people that want to challenge and try to grow peaches, that they do have a fairly good crop of peaches this year, as well as apricots. The other thing that plays a role in that is our frost. And this year, for some reason, we probably did not have frost in the season when both the peaches and the plums. We have a very heavy plum crop this year as well. And so I think that plays a greater role in it.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And I'm going to keep that trap baited right through. Actually, I usually pick them when they're about three quarters. Once in a while, the the other animals, they come. They can give me problems.
Usually possum and raccoon.
I've caught a possum already out there.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I'm in a very high residential area. I shouldn't be having all these animals, but they're there.
There's those little urbanite critters, you know.
Yeah. Not too many predators for them, and so they can survive pretty well. Thanks for calling, Kenneth. Appreciate it. Connie in Keewaskum emailed us. She has a daylily on which the leaves are turning brown from the tip to about halfway down the leaf. What might be the cause of that? They are in full sun, while other daylilies, I have to get shade part of the day, and they do not have the brown leaf problem.
Okay, it could possibly be a disease issue, and I would encourage that person to send a sample into the pathology lab. Because I know in past years we've had some daylilies that have had certain diseases, and Brian would be able to diagnose that. So the pathology diagnostic lab would be a place to send it. If you go on the internet, and you'll find that, and they'll give you how to directions on how to send the sample.
And the UW Plant Disease Clinic or something like that. Ann in Milwaukee, on to you now. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Thanks for doing this program. I enjoy it. I have a couple of questions. I have some volunteer bushes in my yard, which I've been happy to have identified as choke cherries, and I want to know if those need any kind of tending or pruning. They're full of fruit this year, and I'm looking forward to harvesting that.
Well, they make very good jelly. Let's look at the end product.
Yeah.
And you said they're bushes rather than...
Well, they're small. Yeah, they seem to be bushy as opposed to being actual trees.
Yeah. Now, where do you live?
In Milwaukee, Reading County, Bayview, actually.
Yep. There's several species of choke cherries in that. Most of them are small-statured trees, unless you're working with pin cherries, which we find in the sandier areas, and those are almost bush-like. So I'm guessing that your little shrubs are going to turn into some type of stature of tree.
Okay.
You know, you might need to thin them out somewhere along the way. But, yeah, they do make fairly good jelly.
Well, yeah, but pruning, do I need to prune them? I mean, a single tree, then, would I need to ever prune?
I would, yes, I would prune them into a single tree. And there's a few things that you can do to train the tree. That fruit bulletin I said, growing fruit trees for home gardeners that Extension has, you could take some of the information they have there for apple tree management. Mm-hmm. And try to train your tree that way. Because someday you're going to have to decide how you're going to get the fruit off of a 20-foot-high tree.
Yeah.
Oh, they'll get that big. Wow. They're fruiting this year, and they're pretty small. So, all right, and my other question was Nanking cherries. I've got some bushes. They're actually fairly old, but the last few years I've hardly had any cherries at all. And someone said, you got to prune them. And I pruned them not very radically, and I got a ton of cherries this year. And so I've been trying to find out some information on those, but I've found some conflicting things. Some say you should prune in January. Somebody told me you should always prune anything that grows up and not out, any verticals. I don't know which is the thing to do. So if you could
help me with that.
Yeah.
And the Nanking cherries are just seedlings because I don't think we have but maybe one variety that's named in Minnesota has. But basically with that plant, most people train it like a shrub and do some rejuvenation where you save about 6 to 9 productive stems and encouraging 3 new shoots to develop each year. They will get old and woody and non-productive. The other problem is that they probably blossom earlier than any other of our fruit crops, and then
always
the chance of frost can be a problem.
Well, there's been years when they've hardly blossomed, and then they just certainly blossomed a lot this year. So do you think it's more of a question of frost as opposed to a pruning?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We had some tart cherry tree that we planted a few years back, and we had some tons of cherries on them, and the birds got them all, but that's what my wife wanted. She was just planting them for the birds.
Yeah.
That's good. Bob Tomich, our guest on this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Talking gardening today with Bob Tomich, senior lecturer in the Department of Horticulture at the UW-Madison, and with UW Extension, Larry Mueller here. Give us a call with your question at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And let's turn to Marvin in Rio next. Marvin, hold on a second here. Let's go to Marvin here. Marvin, hi. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking the call. Last year I had some... What is Alstomeria, the princess lilies?
Yeah.
And white, yellow, pink, red. The rose chafers, they decided to eat the white one and not the other colors. I fenced it with screening to save it. This year I had a white gallon plastic pail out. There was some water in it. And I found out that they can't wait to dive in them white pails and drowned. It was unbelievable.
Hmm.
Yeah, well, they're attracted to the food source, and they're And we know that certain insects are attracted to certain colors, and that's why they're doing some research on the different color plastics for mulching vegetable crops, is because we know that some will attract aphids, some restrict them. So, yeah, that's an interesting observation. And you brought along the idea of rose chafers. I see that the Japanese beetles are now showing up.
Yes, they are.
And as you look across the landscape, you see the leaves slowly disappear from certain trees.
Yeah, I couldn't believe with those white pails, like the whole area in there in one day would be completely covered.
Yeah, and it's a way to remove some of the population. Unfortunately, some do find their way to the flowers that you're trying to protect. Yeah.
But it really thinned them down. One other question. Will this BT, the thuricide, do you think it works on squash vine borer or caterpillars? It does on other caterpillars.
Yes, I'd have to check specifically on that because some of those borers are the larvae of clear-winged, kind of like a wasp-like structure. So I can't answer that one directly for you.
Yeah. Earlier, I just used some form of carbaryl until the flowers come out. Well, then you got bees and flowers. And
yeah.
That don't work. So
no.
Then I went to thuricide to see what happens.
You'd have to look on the label of the thuricide. It'll tell you whether or not it's going to control that insect.
Yeah.
They didn't name that particular one, but a lot of the other caterpillars. Okay, thank you. I'll get off here. But I thought that idea of the white pails was kind of interesting. I tell you, it works.
All right. Well, thank you very much for calling. And there'll probably be a few more white pails out on the garden. Roses there as a result of your call, Marv. Thanks for calling. Carolyn in Washburn. On to you. Hi, Carolyn.
Oh, hi. It's Marilyn, but that's okay. I was calling because I'm having what I call an interesting experience with lupin in my front garden. First of all, I've never seen them as prosperous as they were earlier in the spring. And now it seems a blight has attacked them. Maybe the upper 12 inches of the stalk is bare. And what I thought was dust from road construction turns out to be just like a black, it's grittier than a powder on the leaves. I'm wondering what you would make of it, and could this transfer to other plants?
Well, that's another sample. If you really wanted to know exactly what it was and what other host plants there are, it would be sending a sample in again to the pathology lab. But from what you described, the road dust, which in this case is usually some type of spores that are produced by some fungus that is growing on there. And with different seasons, for example, this year we had a relatively cool spring, and so we're seeing more diseases showing up on our plant material, partly because the disease was able to establish itself because the plant was growing so slow. And so that may be part of it. As to a control procedure, I would have to do some digging and find out for you on that, but I'm guessing it's some type of fungus that's there.
So when I cut them back, I'm wondering what precautions to take to dispose of the waste material.
Oh, the waste material, I would either put it in a plastic bag and let it rot there or burn the material if you can. You want to get rid of it. And it's better unless you bury it in the ground in a place where you're not going to be digging up something. And then after you do prune off that diseased area, you might want to come back with some type of fungicide material for ornamentals. And there are several fungicides that are available out there. There's Captan products, there's sulfur products, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but another idea is to send in a sample, right?
Yeah. If you wanted to know exactly what was causing it.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call as well. And Carl in Eau Claire is next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a question about a pest that has gotten into my two plum trees. I've got a couple of plum trees that I planted about 9 years ago. They've been very successful. They've done really well. And then 2 years ago, a bug got into them called the plum curculio. I just diagnosed it this past winter doing some research with your extension books. And I don't know what the best remedy is to get rid of that bug. And I'd welcome any advice you've got on that.
Are you doing organic or are you just regular pet?
Well, I'd like to go organic, but I recognize its limitations.
Yep. There are some products out there that your best control for the plum curculio is early in the spring until almost up to flowering, and you can control a good portion of that pest. And they're a walking insect, and of course they come out of the ground and work their way up the tree. There's some products out there like Surflan and some of these K-Lite type clays. I've had people report some fairly good luck with it, and those are organic products, and people are even looking at using those on other fruit trees to reduce the insect population.
Okay. Right. Is there any kind of tanglefoot substance I could put on the trunk to catch them as they progress from the ground up to the tree?
You could try. The problem with tanglefoot, usually you got to put it on a piece of paper or something like that. If it's in contact with the tree, sometimes it can be a problem.
Okay. Well, thanks for your help.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Jane in Colgate, Minnesota. Your turn. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Well, it was nice to talk to you again. I have a cherry tree that's between 15 and 20 years old. I don't know what kind of cherry it is, but it's been a good producer. And the last 3 years, after the blossoms fall and the cherries start forming, the leaves on the ends of the branches turn brown and dry, and there aren't as many cherries then. And I don't know, I'd called the extension office, and they couldn't tell me, but they'd given me a master gardener's name, and he said he didn't know the answer to it either, but he had tried Liquid 7 on his fruit trees, and that seemed to be good for them, but he said it might not work. So I needed to have an answer from you.
Okay. One thing is, usually your cherry trees, the life is somewhere between 20 and 25 years, and so you're up there.
Yeah,
I'm guessing the variety that you have is probably either North Star, Meteor, or possibly Montmorency. That's your options pretty much for that part of the country. As for the browning, do the tips of the browning tip kind of curl over like a shepherd's staff, or does it stay straight and brown?
Yeah, no, they kind of just hang down. I mean, they get brown and then they just hang down.
They don't
real, you know.
They don't curl.
No, they don't. Well, yeah, they do a little bit. I'm looking at them now. Yeah, they do.
Because what you've kind of described, there could possibly be fire blight, which is another issue. And again, diagnosing a sample, I'm sure the University of Minnesota has a pathology lab that if you check with your local extension office, they could probably direct you to a person where to send a sample for diagnosis.
Or you could send it
over to Brian's lab here in Wisconsin. The plant can't tell if it came from Wisconsin or Minnesota, and we could give you a diagnosis as well.
Oh, well, good. That sounds wonderful. I think I'll try that.
And when you send us a sample, not only send the brown stuff, but right where the browning starts on the tree, so you get some healthy wood as well as some of the diseased wood.
Yeah, they go back about, to 7 or 8 inches in on the branch, you know.
Yep. That's what makes me wonder if it isn't possibly the fire blight issue. If that's the case, we usually recommend pruning at least 1 to 3 feet below that brown area, because that's a bacteria that's traveling in the vascular tissue, and where it's dead has already plugged the vascular tissue, so it can't get water anymore. That's why it's browned out. So that's possibly what's going on.
Oh, that's interesting.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. An email from Ellen of West Bend. You mentioned that thistle should be giving the Roundup treatment when they are 4 to 6 inches tall. How timely. Tomorrow, a group of us at our church, we're going to try to take them in our prairie fields using the glove of death with Roundup. If they're already flowering, should we not bother with the Roundup and just remove the flowers this year? In other words, would it be a waste of time and materials to try to eradicate them with Roundup at this point?
Well, yes. It's like this. You better have another party. This time, go through and cut the thistles that are there to get rid of the flower heads in that. And if you come back in about 2 weeks, you look right, in your areas, you'll be able to tell that there's new shoots coming up, and then you want to do the glove of death. approach to killing them.
All right. And then my neighbor has a garden with about a dozen tomato plants. Several of the tomatoes are wilting on the top one-half to one-third only. No evidence of bugs or discoloration. The two of the affected plants are next to each other. Another is not. We think they're all VFN resistant, and they get watered regularly.
Well, it could be a walnut tree close by. This will cause wilting. So you might want to check that out. If there's one in the vicinity, the roots can get over into the area because you've been watering the lawn, it's been dry, or watering your garden, it's dry. And so when the roots are there, they produce a product called juglan, which impacts certain plants, and tomatoes are very sensitive to that. So that could possibly be your issue. Another thing you can look at is kind of in the wilted area is peeling back the bark or the outer skin layer. And if you see brown streaks in there, that could be a cause of some type of fungal problem. So the wilting is being caused by some type of either juglan or the black walnut product, or I'm guessing some type of fungal problem. And there are some fungal problems that get up into the stem and cause it to start wilting.
There you have it. And thanks for that great answer. Bob Tomich, Senior Lecturer in the Department of Horticulture at the UW-Madison and UW Extension, our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Bob Tomich, Senior Lecturer in the Department of Horticulture with UW-Madison and UW Extension, and he's here to answer all of your gardening questions. I know we have a lilac question, a lilac with scales. I know we've got a dandelion control question, and I know there's a question about which peach varieties would be best for the Trempealeau area. So that's another question that we have. I think there's a question on pumpkins as well. And maybe there's a question from you, and we can talk, listen, the lawns or the garden or the fruit trees. Give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. And we'll be back with Bob right after this look at the news. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Net. Larry Mueller with Bob Tomich, Senior Lecturer with UW-Madison and UW Extension, where he's in the Department of Horticulture. Glad to have him along, and thank you for listening. Lots of callers online, so we go right to the phones. And Kristen in Franklin. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I recently moved to a home with an actual yard, and we aren't allowed to have fencing between yards. So I have six lilac bushes between 10 and 15 feet tall as a property divider, and one of them has scales so bad it didn't even have leaves this year. So when I cut it down to the ground, I saw a green center in the trunk, and I'm hoping it'll revive. But I see scales in two adjacent bushes, and I would hate to lose my privacy hedge. And I'm wondering what I can do.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure if the scales are causing a complete problem. You might have something else going on there. But with scales, this is more of a Phil Pelletieri type question. And I think if you email it on to Larry, he'll mail it to me, and I'll get it to the right person to get you an answer. How's that sound?
I tell you what. Actually, here's a shortcut way to do it. Go to the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. And if you just put that in a search engine, you're going to go to Phil Pelletieri as the person and send that question to him, and I'm sure he'll have an answer for you, Kristen.
So insects cause scales?
Well, you're talking about little things that are on the leaves or on the trunk, right?
They're on the trunk, and they almost look like crescent-shaped.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
They're in the insect area.
Yep.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you for your help.
Yeah. Okay. Insect Diagnostic Lab. That's great. The place to go.
And on the being on hosta, you don't hear that very often. I'm in on hosta, on
lilac.
And so I think sending a sample would probably benefit a lot of people.
Well, yeah, sometimes there's some other problem that is the reason the scale or other predators are there is because of another issue that the lilac is having. That's right. Jim in New Lisbon, on to you now. Hi, Jim.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you today?
Great.
Enjoy your show very much. I have kind of a unique situation. I built a root cellar. What I did was I sunk a plastic water tank about 8 feet round, 6 feet high, down into the ground. I surrounded it with dirt on the sides, and I have sod there. The issue I have a question for you about is on the top of the root cellar, I want to put some type of growth to hold erosion and also give it shade. And I want something that will come back every year, but I only have about 2 to 3 inches of soil. Do you have any recommendations on something that I could either seed or plant up there that will hold that soil and then also survive our cold winters and come back the next year?
Well, if you have up to about 4 inches, you should be able to grow some turf up there. And when it's dry like this, it'd be essential to water it on a weekly basis just to keep it green and carry it through, because otherwise it's not sucking water up from below because of the plastic
right.
container that you have there. Some other options you might want to look at are some of the vine-type crops. It's kind of just having the vine grow over the top of that area, but then you're going to have that erosion control because the vine are going to keep grasses out. So
right.
I would lean on the grass issue if you possibly can.
Yep.
How about, do you have any recommendations for that ornamental-type grass? I really like the look of that, and it does come back year after year, and then I wouldn't have to try to weed whip at the top. Any recommendations on something like that? Would that hold in that type of level of soil?
You're talking about the tall ones?
Some of the grass,
yeah.
It's like it almost looks like quack grass, but it's green and white. And
some of the switch grasses?
Yeah.
You're going to have one. You could try growing them there.
Okay.
The problem you're going to have is that with the switchgrasses is, again, getting moisture to them because you have that. It's like on a cement block.
Right.
I see people with septic tanks.
Okay.
All of a sudden they wonder why they got this square out in their lawn where the grass has died when
yeah.
it's been
yeah.
dry. And you got the same type of scenario going there.
Okay.
All right.
All right. I appreciate the help so much and have a great day. God bless.
Yeah, you as well. Thank you, Jim. Darwin in Milwaukee, it's on to you. Hi, Darwin.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have this year a problem with growing all sorts of greens. I have collards. I have also cabbage, red cabbage. And I'm seeing circular holes in the leaves. And some of them have actually looked lacy. Now, I've been looking for a bug of some kind. I've come out in the morning, looked at even. I never see anything, so I don't know what I might be dealing with.
You might be dealing with a night critter where there are things like cutworms, slugs
okay.
that will...
Slugs
you might
out.
Want to go out there about 10 o'clock at night and take
okay.
a look. The other thing is on the back side of the leaf, like if there are cabbage butterflies, I don't know if you're using any... Are you using any pesticide at all?
Nothing right now.
It's a good chance if you look on the underside of the leaf, you'll see some little small green worms, but someday they're going to get bigger.
Okay.
And that would be that white cabbage butterfly. If you've seen any of those flying around your garden.
I have seen them. Yes, I have.
I would say take a peek under the underside of that leaf, and you're going to find a population there.
Any recommendation for what kind of...
Well, you've got it. If you want to stay on the organic side, there's the BT products, Bacillus thuringiensis, which
okay.
works fairly well. The issue with that is you have to have it on there early enough because it'll kill the young ones because they can ingest enough of the bacteria product to kill them. Once they get a half inch or quarter or three quarters of an inch long, and it's not going to do anything. There are some other products out there like Seven, garden dust, any of those garden dusts, and it'll tell you re-entry waiting or harvest waiting. With some of those, you have to wait about 3-4 days from the time you harvest or apply it and harvest it. So
okay.
follow those recommendations on the container.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling, Darwin. Appreciate it. Carl in Trempolo wonders if you could recommend some peach varieties and tips for growing peaches in the Trempolo area.
Well, in Wisconsin, that's always a challenge. But if you get one to fruit, it's worth it, even if it
yeah.
happens every 5 years. There are some hardier ones that the University of Guelph out in Canada are working on. And they usually have the word harrow, H-A-R-R-O-W, like Harrow Beauty and Harrow, a couple of three other names on it. Harrow Diamond or Diamond Harrow. Those are, I have found over the years, are fairly hardy varieties. Other things you might want to try is something like Reliance or Madison. I've had people say they've had fairly good luck with those. I hear rumor you might want to check the extension if either Minnesota or Iowa suggest any varieties? Because I know they're trying to improve the hardiness on some of those varieties. So take a look at that. But if you can find the Diamond series or the Harrow series, you're in luck. And trying to find those is rather a challenge.
Bob in Rockford, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Two questions. One's easy, one's a little tricky. Onions. I just harvested my onions, and they look like long scallions. I planted them in late April or early May. And I don't know if I used too much fertilizer or if I planted at the wrong time, too close together.
Did you use ball blitz?
Yes.
And how deep did you plant them?
Just till they were covered.
Oh.
And then I added soil as they grew.
Yep. I think it's you planted them too deep or they were too deep. That shoulder of the onion bulb has to see sunlight in order to pick up the photoperiodic responses for bulbing. If you take a regular onion bulb and plant it down 4 inches in the soil, you're going to get scallions to grow.
Okay, that's it then.
So you're into next season.
Yeah, and the other one is I live next to a pasture, and I get moles. Do you know anything I can do about it?
Well, they're coming. The reason the moles are coming into your yard or your garden is that they're insectivores. They eat insects.
Right.
And so they're after some insect, usually in the garden. They probably be eating white grubs or something like that. Usually trapping is about your best approach. They make a harpoon trap. I've heard Scott Craven, our biologist, mention that many times. That's probably the most effective control mechanism. You step down the trail that they've made, set your trap there. When they come to open the tunnel up, it's oops.
they're tricky, but I've tried X-Lax. And also firecrackers. Have you heard anything about those ideas?
Nope.
No.
They don't work.
They don't work.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Is there a general rule for planting on a lot line? JJ wonders. How much distance should one allow for spread growth of a particular plant? The owner's responsibilities, the neighbor's rights for trimming? Is one required to leave enough space for mowing and yard care by the neighbor?
Well, I check with your village and city ordinances. Sometimes there are ordinances on such things. In terms of trees, it's always good to set them back from the lot line about 5 feet, and that way the root bowl and everything else isn't going to impact their yard. But and the same thing with shrubs. I mean, it's a good neighbor policy. Setting them back about 5 feet, I think, allows most shrubs to fill out and not really be a challenge for the neighbor. But there are some cities and some villages that do have ordinances about how close to a lot line one can plant.
And your neighbor, if your branch is growing over onto your neighbor's property, I think in most cases you'd probably have the neighbor has the right to
eliminate it.
Cut it back to the lot line.
It's got
to
be a good variety of apple, and then you can get along better.
Okay. Diane in Michicot, your turn. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Bob. I'm so excited to have my call go through. I was driving into Michicot last week, and my call would have been next, but we ran out of time. And
ooh.
I'm in the Family Market parking lot, and the call got dropped. It was well before the news.
Oh.
I'm so excited. I would like to go organic. I have more dandelion than grass in my yard, and I was getting the Gardens Alive catalog, and they had some kind of an organic corn byproduct that you put on your lawn,
yeah.
And it was rather expensive, and I wonder if there's something available that would be cheaper or if that actually even works.
Well,
and,
do you have any ideas? It's corn gluten that they're talking about. And what corn gluten does is prevent seed germination. So as the dandelion seed shows up in your lawn, it'll keep it from germinating. But those that are there, they're going to be there. And so that's where the about the only way you can get rid of those organically would be to, they have these little digging devices where you want to dig down about 3-4 inches below the crown and you snip off that root system and then pull those out. I think they call them popper, you know, dandelion poppers
Yeah.
So, you know, you have that for an organic approach. Otherwise, you know, you can make good dandelion wine. There must be some recipes on the internet.
Great.
And
well, thank
you so much.
Yeah. And in Europe, they use the early dandelions when they first start coming out as a salad green.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Well, I have enough of them to last for 10 years. So.
All right. Get the popper out. Get to work there, Diane. And of course,
I think the wine sounds like a better idea, Larry.
Wine's a lot better idea. Roman in Sheboygan. Hi.
Hello, guys. How are you?
Great.
Well, you sure are a lot smarter than the car talk guys, so this is actually kind of fun. I've got a red maple about 3 years ago. Straight as an arrow, beautiful tree, but little red bumps on the leaves. Are those gall?
Yes, those are a type of gall. We have a lot of those different galls on not only that tree, but many trees.
Mm.
And Phil and Pelletieri, the entomologist, and I were talking about it. He said it's the way spring evolved this year. It was so slow to green up. The insects were there, and the eggs had a chance to hatch before the leaves got bigger and tougher. And so you're going to see that. It's a cosmetic issue, nothing to worry about. In fact, if you look on the end of the branch where the new leaves have developed, they won't have any galls. It's only at a certain time.
Fair enough. That's all I wanted to check, so I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Roman, for calling. JJ had a bird cherry, which is losing its leaves and appears to have sooty mold maybe. Some of the branches appear to have died back as well. The tree sits below a residential power line. I sprayed it with malathion a couple of weeks ago, and it seems to have slowed the leaf drop.
On a birch tree?
No, on a bird cherry. Sorry.
Hmm.
Prunus spatus?
Ooh. Okay. I'm not real familiar with that one, but I have heard of it. And a couple of challenges you have there is it's possibly due to some type of root rot situation where it's declining. That's why it's losing its leaves. The other thing is that tree is fairly susceptible to canker problems. And you can usually tell if it's got cankers because it's going to have kind of a blackishness or almost a gummy substance coming off the trunk or in the crotch of the branch angles. So if that's the case, it's time to start over. And you might want to look at a little different species of Prunus.
All right. 2 years in a row, Jose has planted habanero plants in his garden. In both occasions, they do not grow and the leaves lose the green color, turn a bit yellow. I have tomatoes growing in the same plot with no issues. Could it be my soil?
I don't think it's your soil. It could be the plant material. That's a question for Jim Nienhaus when he's here, because Jim is fairly familiar with it's actually
he's the habanero guy.
Well, it's a tropical, more tropical type of plant. It's probably hard telling. I don't think it's your soil. It could be some root rot situations, and some types of those plants need very warm weather, warm temperatures. And many times in Wisconsin, until about 2 weeks ago, we didn't have that type of thing. So that could be some of the issues that are there. Otherwise, I'd be guessing.
Carolyn Appleton says, I have bright gold patches appearing in the mulch in my garden. I tried to search for this on the internet and found a photo labeled dog vomit fungus.
That's what you got.
The gold turns pale, and if disturbed, turns into a black powder. And that's what it is, huh?
What it is the bark chips in that are decomposing. And the slime or dog vomit, that's the name for the fungus that's growing there, is decongesting the bark chips. And you'll find it anywhere. And I believe our pathologist, Brian Huddleston, had made a comment about 3 weeks ago that it was starting to show up. So it's there. And
there it is.
It's part of the nature's life cycle.
Not going to hurt anything.
Nope.
Jim in Wales. On to you now. Hi, Jim.
Good afternoon. Enjoying the show. First time caller, actually.
Thanks for calling.
I have a thing for maple trees, and every year I go out and buy some. Well, I thought I'd save a little money and try to grow my own from seeds of interesting trees I found in the area. And there's one maple tree that doesn't have these seeds. We called them helicopters when we were kids.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering how the heck would this tree procreate?
Well, from a cutting, because what's happening is maples come in male and female. And that tree that you're seeing with no seeds on is a boy tree, and so therefore it's not producing any. The way they would propagate that tree, if it has some unique characteristics, would be to do a grafting technique where you either do a bud graft or a stem graft onto the rootstock of a regular maple, and then it would procreate that variety. There are varieties out there like Autumn Blaze and Autumn Bliss and some of those, and Sunset, I think, are some of those. Those are male lines. They do not have any seeds, and they've been selected because of their bright leaf color in the fall.
Right, exactly. It's a dark, dark red.
Dark, dark red. There are some purple ones out there like Burgundy and some of those as well.
All right.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Jean and Ladysmith. Your turn. Hi, Gene.
Hi. I am curious as to how I could propagate lupine. I have some lupine in a wildflower garden. And what's the process for picking the pods and drying them and then reseeding?
Yeah, lupins are difficult to propagate. And your approach going by seeds is better than asexually. So you're on the right road. One is to let the seeds mature on the plant itself, and the seeds are very hard, and so you almost have to use a scarification process. You might want to take an old coffee can, throw a little sand in there with the seeds, throw it in the back of your truck, and run around for a week, and that'll grind the seed coats a little bit, and then plant them out in the fall in a spot. And then sometimes you've heard me suggest this for other plants. Take a 5-gallon bucket, cut the bottom off of it, set it down, and spread the seeds in there along with a little, you know, cover them with either some compost or something like that. Water them in the through winter. And they need that chilling process in order to germinate next spring. But by having them in the bucket, you know, one, the mice aren't going to come through and eat the seeds. You'll know where to find them come spring, right? Because the whole garden looks the same, and you might see some small seedlings start growing, but they're very difficult to grow.
Oh. All right.
Okay.
And you're going to get a variety of colors usually when you do that because of cross-pollination.
Absolutely. Good luck, Gene. Jody in Waukesha, hello to you.
Hi. Say, last year I planted a pumpkin plant. I have a small vegetable garden, and it was doing really well. It had pumpkin setting, and towards the end, I think it was the end of July, beginning of August, I went out there one night, and here the fruit is just covered with these gray beetle-y bugs, about a half inch long. They kind of look like what we call a box elder bug, but they were solid gray, black legs, and it's like they suck the juices out of everything. I tried spraying with insecticidal soaps, it didn't do anything. And eventually the fruit shriveled up and the plant died, and that was that. But I'm wondering what it was, and I want to plant pumpkins again. I don't want to go through this again.
Yeah.
Well, I do two things. One, when you catch those insects, send it into, again, the insect diagnostic lab. Phil can tell you. It's not only their feeding, but probably in their feeding activities, they were spreading some soft rot diseases or diseases into the pumpkin fruit, and that's why they kind of just wilted and deteriorated. I've seen some of these giant pumpkins that are 200 and 300 pounds collapse in a day because something has been feeding on it and a soft rot gets in there and it multiplies very fast. And I suspect that's probably what you were subjecting or seeing. But one product you might, insecticide soaps work fairly well. Pyrethrum products, if you find those on the market, they give off an odor, and some insects just don't come in to taste it. They smell the odor of the insecticide, and they stay away. So, and that's, I believe, on the organic or rotenone product. You might want to take a look at that if you want to stay organic.
Okay. Good luck. Thanks for calling. And another quick one. Jeff from Racine planted lupine and hollyhock 2 years ago, never planted biennials before. Do I plant the seeds they make this year in order to get flowers next year?
Yes. Usually hollyhocks are biennial, and you'll find that seeds just drop in the area. I've got some next to my garden plot, and they start popping up in the garden. I just dig them out when they're in about the third leaf stage and set them where you want them. They almost come up like weeds. And lupins, the other individual had a challenge in starting them, but they will start naturally. And when you see those small little seedlings start up, just kind of move them into the plot where you want it. But they do go through some natural seeding if you work up the soil. And then you have to be very careful in the spring when they start coming up. You don't want to use a product like Preen. That prevents root development on those young seedlings. It's for weed control, but it's weeds and plants you want. And so that's a product that will not, so you don't want to be using something like that.
Bob, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. The time flew by again.
It's gone.
About 25 emails here and a bunch of callers, but we'll you'll be back. We'll do it again.
Yeah, we've got another date scheduled already.
Sometime mid-August, I believe.
I think we're coming in the 18th of September.
Oh, 18th of September. Okay. Bob Tomich, senior lecturer in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison and UW Extension, our guest. He'll be back, and we'll do it again. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Net.